Welcome back to Film Posers, for Boricuas ranting, raving, and reviewing cinema. Today, we are going to be talking about Jennifer's Body, and we're going to be breaking it down. And the moderator will be me, Juan Mojica, our resident Jennifer's Body stan account. So, I'll be honest, y'all. This is going to be an extra salty episode. If you hate this movie, then you not only hate cinema, but you're also totally jello that a female director did what some of your favorites couldn't do. In fact, you're lime green jello.
Lime green jello.
Lime green. Not lime green jello.
And if you got those jokes right away, you're in the right room. Because, see, Jennifer's Body is, I think we can all agree, a cult classic that deserved better. But if you don't know what it's about, Jennifer's Body is about a newly possessed cheerleader turns into a killer who specializes in offing her male classmates, and can her best friend put an end to the horror? So I'm going to start off by asking, what are the film poser's first thoughts to Jennifer's Body? I'm going to start with our resident horror expert, Anna. This is our month. It's hot. It's horror month. Spooky season.
Spooky season. Spooky, it's upon us.
And it's only right.
As y'all know, as resident horror fan, of course, I love Jennifer's Body. However, we're going to get more into it later because the movie, it is marketed as a horror film. However, it does have certain aspects to it. But I think what was more important in this film is the message per se. And I really like how Cody Diablo uses these horror elements to it and the tropes such like the virgin and the final girl and, you know, the succubus to give out this kind of message that I felt that when it came out the film, people didn't get.
Totally love your perspective, Anna, and also love that new nickname for our girl Diablo Cody. She did a great job on that script.
What?
Miss Cody Diablo, you are film poser approved here. Let me tell
Joe
you.
Joe Spicy.
From Joe Spicy, Joe, you're passing on the torch to Cody Diablo. And and Anna, we're definitely going to talk about that marketing. Let's get into that in a minute. But first off, we're going to move on to our next resident poser, Miss Josie Melendez. What are your thoughts on Jennifer's Body?
The funny thing is that, like, the first time I saw this movie was when it came out, and I was, like, in eighth grade, so I don't know why I was watching this, but it was a sleepover, and it was one of those moments where you're like, ooh, let's watch something we're not supposed to watch, and I was just sitting there like, what the heck? What the heck am I watching? And I remember just hating it when I was younger, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around what specifically is the purpose of this film. I just rewatched it for this episode, so I'm still confused as to what the purpose is, but I definitely appreciate it more now. But of course, when I was younger, at that time, I think it was a little bit more difficult to understand what was trying to be done, because even though, like, it is considered a cult classic right now and some people view it as like a queer and feminist staple, there is kind of like a lot of internalized misogyny in this film. So it was very hard for me to vibe with it before. And now, like, again, warming up to it, because there is a lot to appreciate, but I still think there is a lot still that shouldn't be as appreciated, you know?
I totally get where you're coming from. Again, this was released in 2009.
It was a product of its time.
Yeah, and we're going to get to whether or not this film is ahead of its time or not. We're going to get into that.
Yeah, it really depends on the lens you look at it from, yeah. Or the game, better yet said.
Yeah, and your comments are actually pretty common in the sense of some people who try to look at this film with more of that critical lens. So I definitely like that you're bringing that to this episode. We're going to get into it.
Get into it soon.
But real quick, though, true or false, that this film, if it were released recently this year, given a certain album that came out, do you feel that the song I Am Not a Woman, I Am a God would fit perfectly for the soundtrack.
Listen, this film is making a resurgence. You had references to Jennifer's body in Good For You, Olivia Rodrigo's music video.
Yep.
And then you have I Am Not a Woman, I'm a God by Halsey, which of course refers to the fact that they are she, they. So there's also that. But of course, a lot of people did bring up the Jennifer's body thing, and that also plays into it. So there's a resurgence with this film, and for good reason. I think there is a lot of good to take out of it. So I'm going to say true.
Absolutely. Plus, let's not forget Manic killing boys using a snippet from what is now a deleted scene from this film, which you saw in the trailers, if you originally saw it, where Amanda Seyfried says the infamous words, "You're killing people." And Megan Fox responds, "No, I'm killing boys.
Yeah.
Halsey, you're definitely film poser approved. Love that.
Oh, like Halsey loves Jennifer's body. No doubt about that.
And we love to see it. So moving on, Gabriela, what are your thoughts on Jennifer's body?
So I saw this film for the first time this year, like a couple of months ago. I am late to the party, I know. But, you know, as it came out, when I was very young, and from the very beginning, it was clear that that was a film I was not supposed to watch. So
take it from me.
So I apparently decided to be very obedient, so obedient that I didn't watch it until this year. I really liked it. And I remember thinking how, to me, what would make me absolutely love this film would be the ending. And so when it nailed that ending, I was so happy. I understood why this film is such a cult classic and so many people love it. That ending was just so perfect. And it's so camp. And it's just a lot of fun. I understand why some people don't like it. It's clearly not for everyone. Not everyone's going to appreciate that humor. You know, the campiness of it.
It's the epitome of camp.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I do agree with what Josie said. You know, some of the jokes and all that. Again, 2009. It was a product of its time, like Josie said. But overall, I did really like it. And yeah, I was honestly, as I watched it, I realized that I literally knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about this film. So the entire time, I was surprised at the plot, at the turns that it took, and all the twists and all of that, because I literally had no idea about anything that happened in this film. I never got spoiled. So it was a wild ride. And I didn't know Adam Brody was in it, so that was a fun surprise.
Ah, the eyeliner.
I know. And I know why some people hate Adam Brody because of that movie. Now I understand, because I remember thinking, why would you hate Adam Brody? He's like, he was like white boy of the month for so long.
I mean, when you think about it, it's like Jake Gyllenhaal playing psychopaths in every film. Like Adam Brody killing here, being part of a satanic family in Ready or Not, and then promising a young woman being a horrible nice guy, quote unquote. Yeah. So
I mean, now he did Shazam, so at least he's the good guy there.
I think the one that stole the spotlight, it has to be Jake and Simmons' wig.
Oh, that was funny. Yes. I was not expecting him to be there. J.K. Simmons being in this film felt like Bob Odenkirk appearing in Little Women to me. I didn't know he was in it, so when he appeared, I felt like that scene in Little Women when Bob Odenkirk appears.
Yeah, I forgot he was in this movie, and then he's just saying, I can't remember the line anymore, and I'm like, J.K., you okay? You okay?
Oh, yeah, in the classroom where he's like, it doesn't matter who you call and who you call. Just so we can edit out those curse words. Because, you know, that's definitely where I see Josie's comment of the eternalized misogyny in that scene.
Yeah, not just that. It's just also in the behavioral aspects of a lot of the characters. But we can get into that soon.
We'll get into that soon. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, I'm the Stan account. So I'm just going to read my favorite Letterboxd review to summarize what I think about this film. And that is Jennifer's body greater than The Godfather. So let's move on.
I mean, you're not wrong. I think
my favorite one is This is Twilight for bi girls. And let me tell you, they're not wrong. And this is because I was going to look for it before this episode. Please someone confirm this for me. Like, the soundtrack sounds very similar to the Twilight soundtrack.
It does.
It was 2009. Like, New Moon had just been released too. So
I found the composer. Okay. They did not do Twilight. They were pretty similar. So I'm just saying.
At that time, the alternative scene was taking off a bit. For example, you had Fall Out Boy at that time. You know, they were still off the high for Infinity on High. They had just released in 2008 Folie à Deux. Like, they were doing well.
Yeah, but it was mostly, well, also because Jennifer does have a Fall Out Boy poster.
Oh, I was going to get to that.
She's following Low Shoulder on MySpace, so we're clearly into this indie rock band kind of vibe, but I was referring more to, like, the actual music, like, the score, not the,
yeah, because
they
sound.
Also have, like, Florence and the Machine and all that, but I was referring more to, like, the score. It's very similar to Twilight. Like, if you watch this, Twilight, yeah. They sound very similar, which I appreciated because it definitely captured the vibe of what people were into at that time.
So I do think the score is similar. And I think the best way to summarize that is that's the score of our youth. We're going to hear that and go, remember when we were young. Great introduction. Now let's get into the tea. Next subject, from flop to cult classic. So Jennifer's Body is labeled as one of the films that originally did not do well at the box office, but got that cult following later. It had a weak opening weekend at the box office. And ironically enough, this was marketed, like Anna was saying, by raising the sex appeal to appeal to the male demographic. And it was called, quote unquote, a sex romp for straight boys. It was hyping up the kiss between Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried in the trailers. They over-sexualized the film to appeal to the male gaze. They capitalized on the fact that at the time, Megan Fox was having a good year, a couple of good years, ever since Transformers, and they were giving her the title of sex symbol, one of the hottest women, you know, around, and they were really using that for the marketing so that because they thought the male demographic was going to show out more than the female demographic. Which ironically is not what ends up being the case, but we'll get into that. And what this film really is about, which they should have touched on, is the female friendship aspect, the horror tropes it touches on. The marketing really dropped the ball because even by appealing to that male gaze, they couldn't get the box office in. So they were trying to bury that film, from what it seems. Because again, I wasn't in the room when it happened.
Yeah, I remember when I saw it, it wasn't in theaters. It was, like, as a DVD, it was a rental.
Oh, I rented it too. Same year. It was like December 2009. It was a good time. It was fun. But honestly, yeah.
2009 was a simpler time.
Yeah. But yes, Anna, you were just mentioning the marketing.
Yeah, because I feel that the distribution company wanted to copy and paste the same thing that when they marketed Transformers. Because they were marketing Megan Fox as the female gaze, you know, the sexiness and the appeal of it. But because the movie, it's not like that at all. And they were trying to appeal and get the same audience from them to move to watch this horror movie. Now, I was reading a couple. I was doing some research, and there was some stuff that it was kind of disturbing that they did with the marketing and some suggestions, and I'm just going to go right into it. Karen Kusama, in one of the interviews on BuzzFeed, she said that the distribution company suggested that what if we marketed the film on an amateur porn site. I was shocked when I read that. Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, it was obviously they said no, but we still see some hints from it, because in the DVD, if you go to the DVD, there's a special feature that is literally called, and I quote, Megan Fox's Hide, which it just showcases a video of Megan Fox, you know, sexy moments in the film per se. basically, it's horrible. There was this, I saw an interview with Megan Fox that she just looked grossed out, uncomfortable in that type, you know, of scenario, because she was with Karen Kusama and they were talking about how they were doing the test audience thing, you know, and basically the majority that were there were men, and they were talking about how there's not enough, you know, cleavage on Megan Fox in the film. And yeah, that's how basically they were distributing the film. It was all about sexualizing her body.
Yeah, and you can tell because in those original posters, if you remember them or you can look them up, she was sitting in the main poster on a desk, like a teacher's desk, and on the back it says, "Hell yeah." And there's a hand coming out of the desk, which is where I believe the inspiration for the porn website came from, because they couldn't get that, so they went for the second best thing. That was definitely the poster they were using to advertise it. And you barely got that it was horror. If you missed the hand, it didn't look that much like a horror poster. And I do understand, because I saw that same interview we're talking about where Megan Fox was upset. And you can tell that she was just really upset that mostly male critics were covering that and asking the same questions, giving the same feedback. And it was like as if they didn't really understand the film. Fun fact, I'm going to mention another thing that I found. With the critical backlash, famous critic Roger Ebert described this film as quote-unquote Twilight for boys, and this critique was meant to be seen as Megan Fox taking over for Robert Pattinson in his role and seen as a silly adolescent sex fantasy designed for straight guys. I found that in an article when I was doing my research, and I gotta say, that does summarize more or less how these male critics were reacting to this film.
Disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And even the production company, because in another interview, I don't know if it was the writer or the director, they said that the first scene that they shot was the iconic entrance that Jennifer did with the jacket and all that, because it looked sexy, it looked appealing, and that was the first thing that you were going to show to the production company. Imagine if you showed something else that wasn't Megan Fox.
Yeah, that scene though, very smartly done, because if you can tell, she's the only one wearing color. Everyone else is wearing a black hoodie or a black sweatshirt. They were made to fade into the background so that the focus was on Megan Fox. That is smart camera work, I have to say. Extremely smart camera work.
Yeah, I really like that scene.
Same. And I do agree with you. I think the only other scene they could have shown first, which I think in some trailers they did, was the scene where she's swimming in the lake, which was to try to like grab their attention right away to be like, oh, as a male, I am interested. They were trying to get that effect so that way it would be a great box office result. And they were trying to encourage mostly men, because then they're like, let's go on a date night to see this film. That was basically their marketing ploy. And when you think about that, that's where Josie's comment of the misogyny really kicks into high gear.
Yeah, I really liked that when I was watching the unrated version, you would think that since it's unrated, because I didn't know this was directed by a woman, you assume that since it's unrated, you will show nudity, and I really appreciate that it didn't.
Yeah, that was the other issue. They called it unrated, but in reality, there's a commentary section on the DVD, and it is labeled not as unrated in that director's opinion. It's more of a director's cut. And what's interesting is sometimes unrated you go for like 7 to 10 minutes of additional footage, different scenes. That's normally what you get with an unrated film. You always use for those R-rated films, sometimes even use for the raunchy films, the raunchy comedies, the sex romps, which is where that comment kicks in again. And here it was just the director's cut. It was just additional camera shots. It was depth to the bar scene. You think about it and you go, they gave them that title because they knew the box office didn't sell, so they wanted high DVD sales. which would go into the ancillary market sales. So
basically, because if you call something unrated, you'll probably get a lot more people into it than if you called it a director's cut.
Exactly. It did well ancillary market wise, but it really just was terribly handled. I think looking at it now, marketing wise, could have been a completely different story, but we're going to get into that later.
I kind of want to add that. So if you also say unrated version, especially it's for the DVD sales, it feels that you're kind of marketing also to the male audience in a way that, oh, we didn't saw that in the theater, but we can see that now on DVD.
So really, it's a ploy that they've used before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it works because it does show those kind of scenes. It depends on the film. But in this case, it's just, again, another example of really bad marketing.
I hate how this film that, you know, has the female gaze, it's written and directed by women, doesn't show nudity, doesn't over-sexualize any of the characters, had to be marketed towards men. You know, a film that was meant to break the female gaze and comment on the female gaze, they had to do all of these things to appeal to men, because if men knew the truth, they would not see it. I think that part of the reason why there was kind of like this looming shadow over Jennifer's body and people kept saying that it was a bad movie is because of the voices of men were louder than, you know,
as usual.
Yeah. Than, you know, other people who watched it and actually really enjoyed it. Because I feel like for the longest time, there was like something about Jennifer's body that held people back from seeing it. And it wasn't until its resurgence in like recent years that a lot of people started saying, hey, it's actually a really good film. It took years for it to gain the status that it deserved from the very beginning.
Yeah, I think that's why I get so confused with this film, because while it is written and directed by women, it might have a female gaze at times. There are still remnants of the male gaze in this film. So there is a lot mixed into it that tries to play to both sides. And that is probably to blame the production team and the distributors and everything, because the film is kind of tainted by the male gaze and probably by male meddling. So I think that's why I get mostly confused when it comes to this film and what it's trying to do, because there are different storylines happening at the same time, and like I never really understand what Jennifer wants, but we can get into that later. Anna.
I feel that also one of the reasons that it flopped is because it didn't meet up the requirements when it comes to the critics, especially the male critics. So by word of mouth, they literally just started shitting on the film. And everybody started, you know, spreading that, hey, the movie is bad without actually seeing. Did you saw it? No, but I just heard that it's bad. So I think that's just the case with this film.
And with that, we're going to segue into our next topic. And that's the question. Was this film ahead of its time? Do you think that if this film was released in 2019, for example, we would be looking at a huger success with critics, with box office? Do we feel the reaction would have been the same? Because thematically speaking, this film has some moments where it would speak to themes that were brought up with the Me Too movement, as a lot of articles have also said. Let's talk about this subject right now, because everyone claims with a cult classic film, it was ahead of its time. You know, everyone just didn't understand it when it first came out. Do you agree with the statement that maybe this film is ahead of its time, or do you think it needed to happen when it needed to happen?
I think this film is both dated and ahead of its time.
All right, and your reasoning for the dating would be the script?
Yeah, mostly like the language, because I do feel like if you remade it now, you would definitely have to change the language because nobody speaks like that anymore. Also, just there were just a lot of comments that I'm like, did anyone ever speak like this? Because I never heard any of this, but I'm just gonna leave it to the fact that it was a small town.
It was a small town, middle of nowhere. The script, though, was actually meant to criticize how high mm-hmm. schoolers talk and yeah. how the lingo they came up with, what was once cool, because Jennifer's the popular girl. Anything really that the popular people say, it catches on in high school. So the terms Megan Fox was using, for many, cringeworthy, but in reality, it's to point fun at the fact that if you see this as someone who just got to college or is later on an adult, you see that and you go, was I like that in high school? Did I speak like that? I maybe didn't say the same things, but you look back at the slang you used maybe, and you're like, whoa, they have a point there. I don't like the way it was used, but you look back and you're like, this is a valid criticism of how high schoolers talk. And even now, you, our age, we see high schoolers now, we hear them talk, and you're like, you kind of cringe a little, but you're also like, wait, that was me.
Yeah, it was mostly like...
But I do agree it's dated in some scenes. It's some scenes were very...
There are some words that, like...
Oh, yeah.
Should use anymore.
It should not be repeated, absolutely. And if you would make that now, you would definitely get that red Sharpie pen. You'd be like, no, you can come up with a better...
still use it.
That's also the problem.
Yeah.
So, okay... I personally don't have a problem with how they talk because I feel that it was purposely written that way. And for me, some of the jokes, yes, are they outdated? Yeah. However, we still laugh about it, especially the Hannah Montana comment.
Oh, that's iconic.
That came out of nowhere.
That's probably one of the most well-known lines of the movie. Also, the scene I probably memorized.
I didn't even understand why she said it.
Me neither, but it was funny.
Yeah, and it still is funny.
Blonde.
Like, is it because she's blonde?
Blonde, yeah. Trying to be the main character. It was definitely a shot at the character who was very popular at the time. So it was that pop culture reference.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like one of the best lines. You recognize some people who are fans of this movie, you tell them, nice insult, Hannah Montana. It's like, oh, so I see you're a fan of Poetic Cinema. You know, they go like that.
I think it's just for me, because going into my writer side of things,
right?
Most of the times when I'm writing, a lot of people like will warn you to not use pop culture references because it can date your movie, which is why oftentimes, like also when you're making a movie, trying not to use that many popular songs because it immediately dates your movie. You can immediately pinpoint what time it's from, which is not to say anything against this film. Again, I don't think, like when I say dated, it was mostly like the usual things, like the gender dynamics and everything, which of course it is a criticism. But if you look at it from a present lens, a contemporary lens from where we are right now, of course it would seem dated, but nothing against the film. But it's just those little things, like too many pop culture references, and oftentimes people tell you not to use, again, that many popular songs of the moment because immediately it causes a disservice to your film.
And thank you for mentioning the soundtrack, because I completely agree with that statement. I've agreed with everything you've said. Now with the soundtrack, and this is going to be my next sub point. If this film,
they were winning.
Florence and the Machine, Panic at the Disco, Cobra Starship. They had so many good songs. I own this album on CD. This is like one of my prized possessions. And thinking about it, if this film was made in 2019, your soundtrack wouldn't sound the same. The score wouldn't sound the same.
Yeah.
Megan Fox would not be starring. And yet this is probably one of her best roles because it tapped into everything she knew how to channel. It was tailor-made for her. I'm not saying they were going to ask her to pull an Evan Hansen and ask her to be a high schooler at this age. No. But, you know, it wouldn't have been the same without the cast that it had. Yeah. The soundtrack.
The score either. The score is good.
It is. I think the main thing is what you said. It does feel dated script-wise. And I think that's the one thing maybe you can reconfigure.
Yeah.
And, but would you lose the essence? That's the question. In some cases.
It would depend. I just think that people probably wouldn't like this, but I wouldn't mind a remake, for example, just because I think that if someone did it, like in the right hands, I think we could be on the cusp of something special, only because, again, there were a lot of things going against this film at that time, which is why it might lead to that confusion to some people like me, because again, there were probably like a lot of different differing opinions as to how this film should be portrayed. And I think if we did it now, considering the freedom we have to express queer and feminist stories, I think we could stumble upon something great. If not, just do more things like what we're doing now. Try to bring out the good from this film that was clearly stunted when it first came out.
Yeah, so I wanted to answer the second part of the question, which is it ahead of its time? And my answer is yes, because I feel that even though the film came out like really like a couple of years back, it felt that people didn't understand the message, because of course we have the distribution company where they try to portray the film about something else. However, throughout these years and with the Me Too movement, it feels kind of, it could have felt like correct if the movie came out with that reassurance of the Me Too movement and how people now are voicing out these type of concerns.
Gabriela, do you want to add something to that, or do we move on?
I agree with what has been said, especially with Josie. I think there are some things that were ahead of his time, but also some things that have not aged well. You know, again, 2009, different time. Didn't really have a problem with the dialogue or anything. You know, I feel that it adds to the campiness of the film. So I didn't mind, you know, how they spoke. But again, that's just me.
All right. With that, we're going to move right along. Jennifer's Body is a very long conversation you can have. This could be a TED Talk. This could be a masterclass. It could be 4 hours. There's a lot to dissect. We're going to touch on important points, as you've noticed. The next aspect, the good for her aspect. Now, if you've been a part of Film Posers, if you've listened to our episodes like Promising Young Woman, Good for Her, you know that's our brand.
We literally talked about Jennifer's Body in the Good for Her episode.
We did.
But here we're going to take a different approach. And that is, while we discussed in that episode the character, we need to talk about here, this is a revenge film. But does it take out the right people? At first glance, maybe you don't pay much attention to the victims. But like Anna had mentioned, there are tropes in here and archetypes that once you analyze, you start to wonder what was Jennifer's motive, which is, I think, what Josie mentioned. We don't get a clear motive. So let's go over that real quick. After the ritual sacrifice, she becomes a demon who feeds on the blood of mortals to retain her youth. Her first kill, as mentioned towards the end, was the transfer student, Amit. And as you could tell in that scene, there was no one who saw him, no one who knew where he was. And it was a section of wrong place for that person, right time for her. Next up, she gets the jock, who was the best friend of the guy who died in the bar. The emo kid, who is someone who got murdered in an abandoned house, construction property, R.I.P. Colin, who, funny enough, if you noticed, in this film, they sexualize more the guys than the girls, which, again, thanks to the female gaze, that works in this film. You don't really have some shots of, for example, Megan Fox, like, lowering the zipper, but it leads to the imagination. With the deaths of Colin, you had the death of Jonas. You saw, really, like, for a moment, you're like, is he about to be the one that's naked? Which adds to the value of this film. Back to the original point. Jock, emo, the nerd towards the end. The one who, while he would be considered a nerd, he could also be viewed as an outcast. But those last two had an emotional attachment towards Needy, but all four deaths would be considered something that they would talk about for a bit, but later on the general public, once they got heard of the news, would forget about them. The names would only be remembered in that small town or those closest to them. And Jennifer could have had her pick of any guy. She could have gone for more popular guys. And there were choices. But she didn't go for them. For example, she could have taken out Chris Pratt's character. She could have. But she didn't. So I'm asking the posers.
I'm salty about that. We had a chance.
She had the chance. But now, let's get into the analysis. Posers. Did she pick her victims strategically? Or was it a case of right place, wrong time? And there can even be an even split, which is what I believe.
Oh, I think it was purely strategy. Because it's not the same thing in, you know, killing a person who isn't really well known. In her mind, nobody will miss him. Therefore, nobody will question. Therefore, she's in the clear. So I think it was pure strategy.
I agree with Juan when it comes to it's an even split. Because in the first kill, it was because she was hungry. And it was the first victim. She was exploring what happened to her and the change. The second one is to see if she actually kind of like starting to like it. But the third and the fourth one, we see an emotional connection with Needy. Because if you see the interactions between Needy and Jennifer and the victim, it felt that Jennifer was jealous of the guys because Needy was paying attention to them, not her. Now, on the other hand, something that I kind of want to add is when it comes to the tropes, it was, in a sense, the director and the writer kind of changed it because we no longer see the males as the dangerous type, it's the women. Because the men, they were like, they didn't even know what was going to happen and they felt comfortable around her and they didn't have a sense of danger to them. And that's something that we don't get to see in a lot of horror films.
Yeah, there's also the aspect of when Chip, like his mom, gives him ladies pepper spray. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the mom is the one that kind of figure out something was going on, but nobody else.
No, it was mostly the thing that she says is that there's a killer out there and it's after boys, so mm-hmm. protect yourself.
Yeah, I remember that scene specifically. She says there is a sicko out there, mm-hmm. out for boys. Before yeah. that, the second kill, Jonas, the guy who's crying out for him, alluded to the fact that he assumed this killer is a male, which adds yeah. to Anna's point. They didn't see someone like Jennifer as a threat. They assumed it was serial killer, cannibal, male. And it's quite interesting, that aspect that Anna point brought up. I love that point. I love it. I totally agree with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, because there's like an extended moment where, at least in the unrated version,
yes,
where the father of the victim just goes like, hey, I'm going to rip off your genitalia and I'm going to nail it to my door like a door knocker, referring to the killer as a man. And then you just see Jennifer swimming in the lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say that also felt like improv, the way he yeah. said it.
But I want to point out a comment that Josie said when it comes to the pepper spray, because if you look into that, if in those kind of scenarios, it's mostly the one that the pepper spray is given is to women, statistically speaking. So again, the roles are bent.
And during a time when that was frowned upon at times, they expected the women to go with the pepper spray in 2009. They didn't really think to give the men the pepper spray. Completely agree. It definitely bent that genre, but it also was, like you said, the mom knew something was going on. And if you notice, this is a supernatural horror film. Some people have a stronger connection with other people. You had Needy with Jennifer, and you also had the mom with Chip. There are some strong connections there, and I believe Josie has a point about this.
I was just going to add that, surprisingly, the script was written in 2007, and the comment that we thought was improvised was actually written in the script.
Really?
Yeah, I just found it.
Well, you know what? It came off so good. It came off like improv, and you know what? That'd be an iconic improv line. So props yeah. off to him.
When it comes to her, I cannot sympathize with the people that she's killing, which usually you think you would, because it's like, aw, you're killing boys. Aw, hot girl shit. But yes, strategic, but it's mostly like she was seeking out vulnerable men, which is considered, like, to see men showing emotion is considered to be weak. So she was seeking out, like, the weaker kind. And Ahmet was lost. The second one was grieving for a friend. And that's when the switch comes in, where she actively is trying to hurt Needy. And that's what I don't get.
I can explain that part very well. So,
yeah,
which would go into the next question I'm going to ask.
And now we'd like to take a moment to talk to you about our sponsor, Anchor, the easiest way to make a podcast.
Jennifer and Needy's friendship started out very young in that sandbox in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, with this question, that Jennifer had a plot with Needy. Now, on Twitter, you see those memes of you're going, if I would have been Jennifer's friend in Jennifer's body, see, I wouldn't have tried to stop her. I would have helped her. You see that meme go around on Twitter.
Yeah.
But here, Needy has the moral compass. She's trying to do the right thing. But Jennifer is possessed. She's a demon. Her mind is, I need to feed. But there's also a bit of Jennifer's personality in there because she survived.
Yeah,
and the personality that you see come out more is the popular girl. I need to, the me first and everyone else second. So the question becomes, do you feel that was a genuine friendship? Because Needy even questioned it in the beginning. Or is it manipulative? My point of view, first started genuine as something that was going to last as a high school friendship ended up becoming manipulative once Jennifer saw that Needy wasn't going to help her, that she was going to stop her.
The demon brought out the worst parts of Jennifer, and I think we can all agree on that.
Absolutely.
But before that, Jennifer clearly liked Needy. They allude to it a couple of times before she's transformed. And they even play into that later, but that's another thing. So genuinely, like, she did like her, and there was, like, again, internalized misogyny. They couldn't do anything about it. Now, was it a genuine friendship? Yes. Though, again, she's toxic. She's toxic. And then the demon just brings it out even more.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those moments where Needy really deserved better. Like, she's trying to be there for Jennifer. And then there's also the aspect that you do kind of get mad at Needy for letting her go in the van. So there are a lot of things you can pick and pick at and dissect.
Absolutely. And great point with that scene where she let her go into the van. I do fear, though, that if Needy would have gone with her, they would have both been taken out, because you know what? You're a witness.
That's the thing. I don't think she would have gone with her. I don't think there's any possibility that her character would have done
that. She wouldn't have gone. She wouldn't have. But she tried her best to try to convince her. And I do agree with you that at points you do get frustrated with Needy. But they're also, both of them, lacking, in some sense, that maturity where Needy has it more than Jennifer.
Yeah, I mean, they're high school students.
They're high school students, exactly. So that feels pretty accurate in that sense. However, my thing with, I feel it could at times be manipulative, is with certain dialogue, yes, it was flirtatious in that vibe. Agree there. But there were also moments where it felt a little condescending. It felt like she knew Needy was going to be there no matter what. Like, there was just no way she felt that Needy was going to betray her, because maybe she thought she was afraid of her, because she knew in the beginning everyone loved Jennifer and no one could believe she was with a friend like me. So it played on those insecurities.
Yeah, again, when I was younger, I detested their relationship just because it felt like Jennifer did not feel like a good friend. And the more you dissect it, like as you grow older, of course, like comparing, like I saw this when I was like 12, 13 compared to now at 25, of course, there's going to be a different perspective. And I can see how there is genuine care there before she's demonized. But there is, like, even she says it in the end, like, despite all of this, I can still see how you weren't good for me and how I probably wasn't good for you. Like, despite everything, like, before all of this happened, we clearly, it's a small town and you were friends since kids. Of course, you're going to continue to be friends if there aren't that many options. But there clearly was a falling out before everything, but Needy genuinely cared about her.
Mm-hmm. It also feels that Jennifer projected her own insecurities to Needy. And I love it how we can see it specifically in the scene where she's putting on the makeup, that she's all like, her life just got sucked out. Yes. But al lado del, like,
she starts crying.
Like
she was applying Noxzema like there was no tomorrow.
She was putting her makeup, and we see a picture of herself.
But also, like, she's crying in that scene, and like you can see the suffering inside, like beyond, like who she's become, like the real person, the real part of her inside. I like you can see it. Especially with that picture on the side.
Yeah. And also just the fact that even in those small conversations that they had, she only talked about herself. Again, she was projecting her own insecurities. And if we see Needy and Jennifer, Needy had a stable boyfriend. She was smart. And she just genuinely cared for her. And I felt that she just didn't know how to handle that, Jennifer, clearly. And also, it does feel that she was kind of in love with Needy. And that she was going to get taken away.
She was.
Mm-hmm. She was. Although, great point by mentioning out Jennifer trying to getting clocked with those insecurities. As you remember the scene in the greenhouse, the iconic scene where Needy asks her, why do you need him? Why Chip? You can have anyone you want. Is it just to tick me off, or is it because you're just really insecure? And Jennifer, you know what? She gets pressed like a panini. She goes, I am not insecure, Needy. God, that's a joke. How could I ever be insecure? I was the snowflake queen. Yeah. That 2 years ago, when you were socially relevant, I am still socially relevant. And when you didn't need laxatives to stay skinny. There is where the friendship for sure was done. Yeah. And I totally agree that that was something where it's a small town. You didn't really have many other choices, but that's why I also feel it wasn't going to last past high school. Once you get to college, you get that new environment. You know what? Certain friendships don't stick. And that was definitely one of the ones that I felt wasn't going to stick if Jennifer didn't get possessed. Jennifer was going to go off into a different college and, you know what, live her life. But I do feel the same way in that sense.
I mean, she also, like, in that same scene, when Needy says, I thought you only killed boys, and she says, I go both ways. So it's, like, it's clear why this is a queer staple as well.
Another scene that was played up in the marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of men, you know, the ones that they were aiming for, the adolescents, they didn't catch that. The adults caught it, which I think is why they also played up that aspect with Megan Fox in the marketing, as if to go, oh, so let's play up that aspect, let's play up the kiss, I think the boys are going to show up. That's definitely how it felt.
Great. Especially the kiss, because that's when
That was featured everywhere.
That's why I was referring to the male gaze, because I think we've been able to see a couple of good films recently that have had the female gaze and have been able to hold attention without sexualizing it. And here there is a specific attention to that sexual drive and that sexual attraction between these two people, because I genuinely believe they did like each other. You can see it between them throughout the film. And especially for Needy, I think Jennifer genuinely knew that she was interested, but she probably wasn't going to do anything because she didn't care that much about having something, more so as controlling people. But with Needy, I think it was mostly like she probably didn't realize it, because even someone calls it out to her and she's like, no, we're just friends. But yeah, the kiss, total male gaze. It doesn't feel like it's made for women. And I think that's when, like, maybe it was, and maybe it's just me reading into it horribly, but it just feels like one of those moments that, like, the prime example of too many cooks in the kitchen for this film and trying to figure out who this film really was for.
Yeah, the studio intervention here really went hard and I think hurt this film very much.
Another thing, by the end of the film, we see that even though a lot of things happen between them, Needy still, you know, cares for Jennifer, and she goes on a revenge for her. So that also plays back with, you know, like, their feelings and their friendship.
Man, this is a wild ride.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna keep saying it. I think they liked each other, but of course there are two different things. Jennifer just cared about herself, and if Needy had realized her true feelings, it probably would have hurt her, because I don't think Jennifer was as invested as she was.
No, I think Jennifer's character, had she not been possessed, would have played that off going to college as, that was just the experimental side of me. Like, very that.
But I also feel that, in a way, Jennifer felt that way because she was losing Needy, and she was losing someone that, you know, like, le echaba flores.
Sí, especialmente cuando ella, she mentions that her mom was out dating the meatpacking guy. So, like, she's always alone, which also, Needy's mom is never there. And she's like, I'll protect you. And then it's like, never shows up.
Her dream, though. Her dream with the supernatural element.
She talks about the dream, and then she's like, one day I won't be there and you'll need me. And then it's like, yeah, because you're never there.
But that's the supernatural element I wanted to mention. She has a dream where they're trying to nail her to a cross, like JC, and to quote the line, and she won't be there to help her. That's right where you said she wasn't there to help her. She went straight to the asylum. There was no insinuation that the mom was there to get her out of it, to say, this has to be a misunderstanding. Wait, it's just implied that she was found guilty, that they blamed her, that Jennifer's mom had the power to convince the cops. To be fair as well, Jennifer had the cops in the back pocket because she was sleeping with the cadet. She said it.
Jennifer's mom caught Needy in 4K.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's pretty hard to, you know, dismiss that when
it's a strong case. It's a strong case. You had Chris Pratt, who was someone who, his character, knew Jennifer quite well. Yeah. And the way Needy acted, for some students, they could have said, you know what, she was weird. And it would make sense, since the boyfriend passed, it was her all along. Yeah. She never liked low shoulder. There was enough evidence for them to vote against her. She had it all set up.
Because, I mean, the entire film is about control. But also, can we just give a shout out to the line that St. Jude, patron saint of hopeless causes, please give me the power to crush this bitch.
Amen, Suri.
Amen.
Mano, again. Absent mom. But also the aspects where Needy felt a connection. I don't know. Yeah, she felt a connection with Jennifer. Like, she could see, like, when she was killing Colin, and then when she's kissing Chip. Like, there is a clear connection between the two of them. And it's very specific. But also, like, the prime example of, like, when, even before she's transformed, she shoves Needy hardcore against the door. And then when she's possessed, she, like, shoves her against the wall, and like, she hits her head, and there's like blood on the wall, and I'm like, so when I saw Cosa, where I appreciate the film, I have been able, like, as I've grown, I've been able to see the good aspects that people do love of this film, but I do think there are some moments that do get lost along the way, And again, I'm just going to blame it on the situation that this film went through, because this is, I'm not going to say a brave story to tell, but for the time that it was made, trying to tell this through that queer and feminist lens was difficult. So I'm going to give it props. But again, there is a lot that leads to confusion amongst the viewers. But if, like, I'd rather trust the perspective of those trying to uplift it now, which are mostly she's and they's, and ignore all the male critic opinions.
All the ones who believe in the misogynist aspect should definitely be ignored, because as we start to get to the end of this episode, you can see that this film was tarnished for being that bold story, like Josie said, mm-hmm. that now is very much commended because it takes the right routes. But without a film like Jennifer's Body, would we have gotten something as brave right away? Because Jennifer's Body is used in a lot of examples nowadays. Mm-hmm. Everyone keeps bringing it up because it has that stamp on pop culture. It has,
it does have its mm-hmm. good things.
It yeah. has its good things that it lends itself to. And it can say, you walked, but now I'm going to run because I'm going to fix what you at the time didn't work with.
I mean, like, so if you think about it, like, Jennifer's Body walks, a promising young woman could run. There are a lot of elements mm-hmm. that are similar, especially like the color palettes and the victim picking. And
the Adrian Brody cameo.
Adam Brody is in too. But we'll see. I think this is a good film to analyze and to talk about. And I do think it can be empowering for a lot of people. But I will repeat what I said at the beginning, because when researching it, I saw this. And it's a perfect way when it comes, it's a perfect thing to mention when it comes to talking about this film. And it's that the film will come off to you depending on the lens you look at it through. If you look at it from the male gaze, you will see a film that is very misogynistic and does downplay its female characters. I mean, Jennifer, for most of the time, she acts like a typical, like, quote-unquote popular girl from school, where she's kind of like, her voice is very high, and she often acts like she doesn't know anything, and especially like her wording and everything and just her mannerisms. But then when it feels like like the typical objectification of a woman that is purely sexual, and that is it. But then if you look at it through a female gaze, there is a lot more. There is like the story of friendship and just the criticism of sexuality, and of course power dynamics between men and women, and how those interchange and switch along the film.
Absolutely. So that will wrap up our main topics. And over on our Twitter, we have a couple of questions, and we're going to get into it.
We got some in the last few minutes.
We did, yay. And we're going to get into it. We're going to start with the first comment we received from Captain Melendez.
Ileana asked, poser.
Honorary poser asked, do you think it would have done better on release had it been made today? Should it never get a reboot or spinoff?
And I think we've touched that a bit.
We touched on the first question, but the second question should be discussed here.
Yeah, so I talked about it, but you guys did not. So take it away.
I don't think it should have a reboot because it is iconic the way it is.
I agree.
Growing up, again, I saw this when I was 12. It has been stuck with me. So I saw someone was like, So as an original thought, I was 1,000% against the idea of a reboot or a spinoff. And the reasoning for it, I started to look at those aspects I mentioned. The music wouldn't have been the same. The score wouldn't have been the same. The script would have gotten better. But when I started to think who I could cast in those roles, I came close. There were some actors that I was like, okay, I see it. But it's, for me, impossible, and not, I wouldn't say close to impossible, but it's very difficult to recreate what Megan and Amanda did. That chemistry is fantastic. They were perfectly cast. Feel that was tailor-made for them. It's a film that goes on the resume and everyone goes, yes, you were so good in that film. It's a staple in their resumes. However, while I feel remaking or rebooting or spinning off this film is like doing that to The Godfather, and I know a lot of men would hate that, I feel that it's a property that, while it should be considered untouchable, the elements that it plays with, the story it deals with, can be told differently. I think there is a way to adapt a film like this where you can pay an homage to it. For example, if you were to do this differently, as someone who is tired of seeing high school horror films like this, I would set this in a college. Give the killer a bigger net to cast. Give the killer, in this case, Jennifer's role, a larger spectrum, and make it difficult for the audience to pinpoint what trope can you explore. I think that's, for example, what I loved about Scream 2. You set it in a college. You have a serial killer roaming through the college. Yes, it had some of the tropes, but you know what? It was technically anyone in that moment that could have been taken out. Will lead me to my answer. I feel, don't do a direct reboot, don't do a direct spinoff, but you can play with the concept. And as for the people who I felt could have maybe done this, the names I came up with were Sydney Sweeney, Anya Taylor-Joy, Zendaya, Jenna Ortega, Madison Pettis, Laura Harrier. I'm sure there are many more, but those are the ones who came straight to my mind that I'm like, if they're going to do a concept like this, I would like to see these women on the long list for who should be cast in what role. And you can definitely see and mix and match who would work best. The guys was a little more difficult for me. I actually put Tanner Buchanan from He's All That because I saw him in the Chip role, but I also saw him in the Chalk role. It's a little difficult to do the guys. I put Timothy Chalamet, not for Josie, but because I saw him as Colin.
Yo aquí pensando en el tipo de High School Musical, the musical, the series.
También. Oh. I also thought, Anna, you're going to...
I'm blanking on his name. Joshua?
Yeah. Joshua Bassett. Mismo. Joshua Bassett. Next up, Aiko Wrights asks, do you think the film was ahead of its time or just had a terrible marketing campaign? Summary, terrible marketing campaign.
Yeah.
Ahead of its time in some aspects, can be improved in others, but overall did what it needed to do for 2009. Dasani Cortez asked, whose sexual awakening was this? Mira. I mean, for me, it was Megan Fox, a young, impressionable boy. Seeing Megan Fox again, of course I'm going to stan. I also discovered Amanda Seyfried in that film, and that's just, they were great.
I will say, I was joking that years have passed and I am still attracted to Colin in the film, and I don't know what that says.
Oh my god. And here I thought
he's attractive. It's the guy liner.
And here I thought que de Daniela Mente pensando que maybe Timothy Chalamet does the role and he has to wear the guy liner and the Converse.
He would be great. Oh my god. History repeats itself.
Hey, if you're listening to us, make it happen. Just saying. And finally, our final question comes from NLE318, unrated or theatrical version? Unrated gives you a full scope because it's a director's cut, like we mentioned. You can watch either, but if you really want to appreciate this film, I'd venture to say, watch the unrated version.
I agree.
Which is on Amazon Prime Video. So just saying, if it's
for four more days.
For 4 more days of this recording. Yeah, oh wow.
By the time you're hearing this, it's probably gone. But I'm sure it'll hop onto another platform.
If it hops onto another platform, watch it. If it's not, rent it. I'm pretty sure Amazon will bring it as a rental. They sometimes do.
And if it's gonna be available on the Criterion channel.
Yeah. For October.
Oh yeah. So conclusion. Criterion channel, you're putting it on the Criterion channel in October. Next up, Criterion Collection Blu-ray. Come on, I'm willing to, you know what?
Oh, voy a dar el
tarjetazo. Estoy listo.
I'm ready. They should collaborate with Fangoria.
Yes! Oh my god, there is a cover of Fangoria that came out.
Iconic.
I actually got a question on my end, which I think we kind of touched on, but let's go. At James P. Poole asks, I want full takes on Low Shoulders merits as a band. And then, jokes aside, how has the passing of time affected the social commentary of the movie for better or worse? Now, Low Shoulder, Juan, you were going to say something about their band.
Yes. Okay, I've been ready. Okay, I have conspiracy theory about why they call it Low Shoulder. When you look at an alternative band's posing, they always have one arm up and a shoulder low, and they're leaning against something. Low shoulder. Usually something to left. That's the first thing. And that is also meant to be a criticism on the alternative bands at the time. Representation-wise, they have the grunge look. So when you look at it and you see, like Josie mentioned, the poster in Jennifer's room, the first one your eye goes to because of the font and the way it's said on the title is Fall Out Boy. This is a kind of a criticism to the alternative lifestyle, the alternative rock lifestyle. For example, Adam Brody looks like Brendon Urie from Panic at the Disco at that time. You see him now and you see Adam Brody, you're like, they're kind of similar looking. They have the hair.
They wanted to be Maroon 5.
They wanted to cast Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy, but couldn't get him, so they got Adam Brody.
I would believe that. And
no, it's true. Like I read it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I would have liked to have seen it. But also, he kind of, with the hair in one scene, looks like Brendon Urie. And I'm here like, that's so ironic considering he's on the album with the song New Perspective. That was funny to me. They do resemble more Fall Out Boy. The Easter egg is there.
And then the second part of the question, how has the passing of time affected the social commentary of the movie for better or worse?
See, some things it gets right. Some things are very cool. Some things are nice elements that you can play with now and expand on more. But other elements, like Gabriela said, it's an unfortunate moment of the time at which it was conceived, where for some, it was considered normal to use those words that we don't repeat, but also some still use it today and justify their reasoning for it. So I think it's both. One foot in the door, one foot out the door, like you said, Josie. I think it's time has been both kind to it and honest with it. It gave it a nice slap in the face and said, look, this works, this doesn't, which I get why people would want to do a reboot so they can fix that. But there's also the problem of, are you sure you can go down that route and make it more successful? Hence my problem with the casting, hence my problem with the soundtrack, hence my problem with the score, hence how you're going to do it setting-wise. You need to get the right people. So time, you've been all right, Jennifer's Body. I think the marketing with that exposure has helped people give it a little bit more of a pass.
And that's all for today's episode. We'd like to thank you for listening and to give a shout out to all the kind people sending love our way. If you'd like to keep up with us, make sure to follow us at Film Posers on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Where can they find you, Posers?
You can find me on Twitter at Gabby_Burgos27 and on Letterboxd at Gabby Cristina.
You can find me on Instagram and on Twitter as Anna_Sophia53 and on Letterboxd as Anna_Sophia.
And you can find me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at Leading Mohicans.
And you can find me at The Josie Marie on Twitter and Letterboxd. Again, thank you for listening. And remember, we're all film posers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.